having begun with meditation, maybe just the encouragement to just keep that kind of, to intend towards, just keeping that baseline of certain grounded, contactful, curious awareness as we go through the evening. So that if at times you're stimulated by what's said, if maybe at times you're provoked by what's said, and as we explore things, and sometimes, you know, in exploring the issues of the world, maybe, and in a certain degree of abstraction, just the willingness to let that be held by a certain presence and attunement to one's own reactions as they arise, certain care and kindness, listening to each other as we go around, so that the sense of our discussions are kind of held by the thread of practice. So before I say any more, I thought maybe we'd just take a little bit of time just to go around, and if you just to say your name and one sentence about your interest in being here this evening. So please.
I'm Catherine, and I'm always interested in how I can take what I've learning off the cushion into life.
Hi, I'm Jonathan. I have a very busy life, and basically, you know, finding skillful ways to, you know, practice my day-to-day life.
I'm Edward, and yeah, I'm just always developing meditation practice pretty early on in working with it, and as you say, taking it from the seats to daily life is important.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Sue, and I guess I relate to wanting to take my meditation to the rest of the 23 hours of the day. But yeah, life's been pretty busy. It's nice to come and connect.
Okay. I'm Anthea. I'm a totally passive and other-driven person, but I'm always interested in listening to what people have to say.
Well, here to open up more and just to make aware different aspects of myself a bit more clear.
Dominic, I'm not really sure why I'm here. Something about individual meditation practice and community as well, ethics.
I'm Michael, and I'm interested in embodiment in modern, busy, modern life.
Should have come along yesterday.
I was a guy.
Okay. Good excuse.
Okay. Hi, I'm Mark. I'm interested, I'm a political activist as well as a practice. I'm interested in how those two are integrated.
Christine, and if I'm honest, I couldn't remember what you were speaking on. But I'd come to your Mara week last year, and I found it really helpful. So when I saw your name, I thought, yep, I'll come along.
I'm Sadie, and I didn't remember either exactly what it was about today, but just being able to be in my body as much as I can through the chaos.
I'm Araxi, and I would like to become a mindfulness trainer, I think. And sort of trying to invent that, what that would be, perhaps with teenagers, and perhaps people with eating disorders, I'm not sure.
Okay. Yes, I'm Sarah. I'm interested in how to make a connection with personal practice and the world out there.
Hello, my name is Danielle, and I'm a meditation junkie.
and if it'll so reason a lot of other people to take things out into the world.
My name is Sarah Jane, and I'm here because I'm just continuing my journey of insight meditation, and also like the idea of learning how to really live that in the city as well. So the title of the course interested me.
Martin, yeah, I'm interested in how my practice extends into the world. Just listen.
Okay.
I'm Richard, and you'll probably find out a bit more about me later.
My name's Miller, and I'm just like you said, I'm interested in kind of practice on the cushion, off the cushion, and also I'm interested in community, because I think to practice your values in the world is an incredible challenge, and I think community can really help. So I wonder if this could be the beginning of something within our community.
My name's Martin, and the first 4 or 5 years of my practice were very much defined by meditation. I mean, it was all about meditation. I was doing a lot of long retreats and meditating a lot very keenly, sometimes a bit gung-ho-ly, I would say. And then in a rather unplanned way, I met Gail, my wife, and in a very short time she was pregnant in a rather unplanned way, and suddenly we were having a daughter, and my practice suddenly had to change. It wasn't going to be defined by meditation in the same kind of way. And in the 22 years since then, which I'm just remembering because my daughter's just about to be 22, that's been my ongoing kind of question. It's how to keep and honour the depth of this practice and actually live in the midst of not just my daily life, but live in the midst of the world. And that means a social world, and it means a political world, and it means a financial world, and it means a world with its challenges, and that reach out into all different areas. And part of that exploration then has been looking at the sort of the heritage that insight meditation, Vipassana, has, which is a monastic Asian heritage. And looking at the extent to which there's a sort of unconscious orthodoxy sometimes, which without maybe even knowing it, references the Asian monastic model, or references the silent retreat model for everything. And of course, silent retreats are wonderful, and Asian monasteries are wonderful, but they're not how we're living, any of us. We're not living in silence. We're not following the kind of schedule that you might follow on retreat. Not for following a monastic life, etc. And the Work, Sex, Money, Dharma course that I taught online and here in London a few years running was one of the ways I was interested to address that with people. And this is really just I proposed this evening to London Insight to just sort of basically to gather anyone who's interested and explore a little. So I'll lead with some reflections, and we'll see where it goes. So in beginning, actually, I've got some notes I've made here, but in beginning, I want to just firstly just to offer some very warm appreciation to London Insight, partly for hosting me at other times and this evening, but also because of, you know, all the goodness and care and kindness and support and work that people offer to make things happen. So, you know, there's a lot of... And that's an expression of people's Dharma practice, right? All those of you who may be involved in whatever ways, I don't know. Just to kind of recognise and appreciate that. And then Anthea and Catherine in being here to organise this evening and setting that up, etc. So partly just to set the tone, to recognise that sort of the service element of Dharma practice. And also I want to lead with that appreciation, because it may be that I say things that might appear to be critical of London Insight as we go along. And if that's the case, I would like the criticism to be seen in the context of an overarching appreciation with, I would say, plenty of room for evolution and development, etc. And also just to appreciate both Richard and Miller, who I asked to come along, and we'll hear a little bit more from them later and some of the things they're doing as a kind of expression of their own practice. So, I've thought first of all of three areas of possible evolution. And I'm using London Insight as a model, which I guess you're all connected with London Insight, right? In some way or another, that's how you heard about coming here this evening. And as I wrote these few notes, I realised they fall into three rather convenient categories. Categories are Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So, first, Buddha. And that's the sense of, you know, the core practice of awakening, right? Of which meditation is the sort of the heart of that practice, and ways in which that can evolve. At the moment, a lot of what London Insight offers are these Sunday daylongs, right? Which, of course, as I noticed being there yesterday, people really value as an opportunity to a day of quite a lot of silence, a day of kind of spaciousness, a day of schedule, a day of support, a day of contact, etc. And so it's beautiful. It's not that I want to mess with that in any way. And one can see if that, when that's the main offering, that form references the silent retreat model very much. It's basically a modified or sort of compressed version of a retreat, mostly in silence, sitting and walking, Dharma talk in the afternoon, Q&A, Dharma, thank you very much, go home. So, wonderful. But what would the offerings that London Insight could provide be like? What would that engine of honouring meditation practice, developing meditation practice in our lives be like if it wasn't referencing a model, Asian or monastic or silent or retreat based, that isn't the model that we're living? So I'm not having some answers for that, but that's one of the questions, right? What would it look like if it wasn't referencing that model? That model's great when you go on retreat. But what would practice look like if it wasn't doing that? One of the challenges, I think, that faces London Insight generally is the lack of more consistent teacher relationship with London Insight, right? There aren't any Dharma teachers for some strange reason. No teachers seem to want to live in London. So that doesn't set a very good example, in a way, right? It makes it seem they all tend to, the ones that live in the UK mostly seem to hide in Devon. Right? Maybe that hide is unfair. Let's take back the hide word, right? They mostly live in Devon, which might well give them the message that the place to practice Dharma is Devon, right? Or you know, some sort of bucolic countryside place. So, I'm not pointing any fingers. I also live in bucolic countryside, although I'm actually about half the time in London at the moment. And the way my life is going, maybe that I'm here more than that. So I'm in some conversation with Zander, the new director of London Insight, about ways to support some more consistent practice. That's the model in the States, right? That most of the teachers, they might go away and teach retreat, but mostly they're living in an urban city and working in an ongoing way with a group of students around them that they have at least weekly contact with. And I think that that offers a whole bunch of dynamic possibilities. It involves the space for teachings that are based in the world people are living in. And then the stuff I know of myself, the one-to-one students that I meet with over Skype ongoingly, the stuff we explore is very different than the stuff one explores on retreat. Because it's the stuff of people's relationships and communication in life and struggles with money or the various dramas people get into. And so having just more teacher contact in that way here in London, I think, would really support that. So one model that we just started to speak about today, actually, Zander and me, was about some kind of three-month program which might have a weekend each month in the program, and then in between maybe there'd be some online contact or something, but some kind of something that's a kind of more accompanied practice form. And that's not just then about contact with the teacher, but also the value of the contact with one another. And those of you who may have done practices where you meet several times with the same group of people again and again, the way that sense of kind of a supportive contact can develop is really important. So that's the Buddha piece. Then the Dharma piece, the actual way teachings are presented. So one thing that always amuses me and I, is the Twitter account of London Insight.
I know.
That's why I led with all the appreciation. So I can't, every time I see a tweet from London Insight, I can't help but notice that the little icon photo is of a green glade, a little path through the forest. And it kind of, I have to summon all my equanimity to. So I would say London Insight needs completely rebranding to remind people that it's that London is a city and everyone's living in a city, and the bucolic imagery is counterproductive, I would say. So some images, I was at the recently, I went ice skating, I was in London over Christmas, I went ice skating at Somerset House, you know, and there's that the Mii Hotel, is it called? Opposite. Anyway, I was in there with some friends, and they had some fabulous photography on the walls. And it really, it was photography that evoked sensitivity, mindfulness, awareness, intimacy. But it was mostly close-ups of detail of buildings. A lot of glass and steel and kind of abstract, like beautiful. So it evoked the qualities of practice, but without reliance on sort of out-of-context imagery. Stephen Batchelor is a great abstract photographer of things. Well, I'm sure he'd be happy to supply some imagery. But you know, that it's not just about the Twitter account icon, but the sense of the branding. It's this referencing again of a kind of referencing greenery, referencing silence, referencing countryside, referencing monasticism, referencing silence, etc. It's very hard to hold your practice together when you're constantly reinforcing the idea that practice is somewhere else. And we have enough tendency already to always think we should be somewhere else, things should be other in some way. And so that basic tendency, if we just explore that, I think some kind of just to look at how things are presented. And I've also been talking with Xandra a little bit, so of course there's a lot of work, all this stuff, and there is some wish and intention to rebrand the website and pull it for out of 1996, where it seems to be firmly the kind of the look and feel in that way. So of course it's work, all these things, but that's something I think that would just help, so that people then living in London, I feel, oh yeah, this is, they can recognise themselves in that, if you like. And then Sangha, third area, sense of community. You know, the community is vital. So these are the three jewels, right? Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And yet, one of the things I think the Vipassana Insight Meditation scene, because it's focused on meditation so much, it's just its weak area. Right? The weak area has been Sangha. Look at other Buddhist traditions, particularly like what was the FWBO, the Triratna, they're called now. They put a lot of energy into Sangha, a lot of collective people living together, livelihood projects, people finding ways to earn money and live together and be held in a sense of community. So that's their model, it doesn't have to be this one. But the kind of the, again, this referencing of a lot of silence, etc., doesn't really help to build community. Like tonight was a perfect example of it, right? You all arrive, and everyone's just sitting here completely silently. It's like, this isn't a silent retreat. It's like, so then, of course, the encouragement, hey, meet each other. It's a great opportunity to foster Sangha. And, you know, partly we're not helped by Britishness. Those of you who are British or smart, in terms of Britishness, it isn't the most sort of socially fluid of cultures, right? But actually, once the encouragement is there, oh, then hi. So just the encouragement for that. I was a few weeks ago, on the way back from teaching at Gaia House, I was asked by a friend and a student to teach something at his Sangha in Portsmouth. And it's a little thing that he started rather shyly a couple of months ago, and people have been coming. And then when I was coming, he put up some posters, etc. And 65 people came, which was way more than he'd ever had attending at that. So he was kind of exciting and glad I was coming, etc. So I turned up, and it was fantastic. It was the best group I've ever been to. I walked in, there was music playing. And people were like, talking to each other. And it just felt very warm. It was like going to a really nice party. Right? And the party where no one's drunk, where everybody's being kind of sensitive and warm and friendly to each other. Beautiful. And I thought, oh my God, all the groups I've ever been to, I've never heard any music playing. So the kind of the classic sitting group model, where people arrive and basically we just let's just get into the silence so we don't have to talk to each other. Oh, yeah, I know how to do that. You know, and then we might listen to a talk and then okay, it's all over. But actually, you know, the supporting some social fluidity, some engagement, some contact, friendship. They also this group in South Africa, sometimes they just do movie nights. They come together and they just watch a movie together as a sangha. Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Rather than we come together, meditate together, then we sneak off and watch movies on our own. But, right? So just some sense of finding ways to connect as a community. And then the another big piece of around community then is to do with diversity. London is a super diverse city. Just looked it up today. Last figures I could find, 2013, 55% of London is non-white. Mm. I don't see that reflected in this room. Mm. I didn't see that reflected yesterday in the 90 people there. And so sometimes it's hard to tell. I don't know how people self-define in terms of their ethnicity. But basically, two, maybe three people were non-white. That's a problem. And it's mostly a white problem. And what I mean by the fact that it's a white problem is, you know, I would imagine that a large amount of people in the room yesterday didn't even notice that everybody was white. And then the thought didn't occur, oh, everyone's white. And why? And it's not a problem amongst people who are non-white. Anybody who comes who is non-white wouldn't notice. And I was speaking about this at Guy House, where the same thing happened. You know, 65 people on retreat, 63 of them white. And it might be easy as a white person to think, well, everyone's welcome. But, of course, those of you who are white, you might imagine whether you went to Guy House or whether you went to London Insight yesterday or whether you came here today, you might imagine you come and it looks interesting, this meditation thing. You look through the door and everybody is black, let's say. Except there's one or two who maybe not. But basically, you might wonder how welcome you'd feel. But you still think, oh, well, I'm interested in the practice, though, so I'll go and check out the website. You go to the website, you see a lot of people meditating on the website, but they're all black. And again, just the way that's whatever that reinforces. So I think there's a responsibility among those of you, the majority here, the majority yesterday, the majority at Guy House, to wake up to that sense of white blindness. The way it actually needs some effort to the sense of sangha to actually be not just theoretically inclusive. Theoretically inclusive won't work for the vast majority of non-white people in this incredibly diverse city, but needs to some effort to be sensitive to what community is, to what sangha is, to what diversity is. And just 10 minutes before I came downstairs this evening, a friend in the States, Dr. Anne Glaig, posted this, which was a sign that she saw at a Dharma center in Washington, D.C. yesterday. It was a plaque, and it said, "We recognize that all people hold unexamined beliefs, assumptions, fears, and prejudices about others, and especially those who seem different from themselves. These beliefs are a great source of suffering for individuals and societies. We welcome people of all races, cultures, ethnicities, sexual orientations, gender identities, classes, religions, abilities, and ages. We're committed to providing a safe place for all people to explore the Dharma and awaken to their true nature. Beautiful. But you see, there's something potent about the explicit expression of that willingness and welcome and acknowledgement and recognition. And when we live in a world that's kind of blanco heteronormative, if you like, where then needs some sensitivity to see what could diversity mean. The more diverse a culture is, the richer everybody in it is. So those are some thoughts about the ways you might consider your own participation in London Insight in whatever capacity it is, and you might consider just, you know, your how you hold your practice and how it can evolve in terms of these three ways: Buddha, the awakening part, Dharma, the way teachings are presented, and what we reference for our model of practice, and Sangha, that sense of community which is so vital. Okay, just a few more pieces. Yes. So, in speaking about that sense of community, then it's something about widening. You know, what do you mean? It's another a good question, maybe. What do you mean when you say Dharma practice? What's Dharma practice? Just to reflect a little, what's Dharma practice? In other words, how much of it, when you say Dharma practice, references meditation? Because meditation isn't a complete Dharma practice. So, just a few thoughts in terms of widening out from meditation practice, a more inclusive Dharma practice than just meditation. And I wrote some of those themes on the description of the evening, which it seems like some of you didn't know what that was, but I wrote something about political engagement and social engagement and meta in action and resilience and virtue and ethics and aging and just different areas to consider and respond to. So it's worth referencing how involved the Buddha was in the social engagement of his time, involved in the political structures of his time and the kind of negotiating with kings and politicians and local administrators and officials, involved in the kind of religious politics of his time, in the debates with the Brahmins and priests and other practitioners, etc. Involved in the sense of social responsibility for the poor of his time and their welfare, and speaking with townspeople about that, etc. And Stephen's Batchelor's previous book, Confessions of a Buddhist Atheist, some of you may be familiar. It's fascinating how it goes into the life of the Buddha in terms of that the socio-political context he was living in, and the complexity of all of that, and then the way we can find all kinds of parallels with the complexity of our life. And yet there's that referencing again. If you think of the Buddha, what do you think of? You think of a lot of meditation, probably. Right? But the Buddha was involved in all kinds of, like, the whole of the social environment of his time. So that's partly why I asked Richard and Miller to come along and speak about some of the political and social engagement that they're involved in, and the ways in which it's an expression of Dharma practice. And the few areas, like the hot topics of our day, right, which often, you know, they tend not to be addressed on retreat, right? Because retreat is about the deepening of one's meditation practice. And yet, A full dump practice. I was really pleased. I put Michael Stone, who's a Canadian teacher, in touch with London Insight, and he's going to be giving a talk later this month here on something to do with social engagement and secular Buddhism and ethical dilemmas. And so I'd encourage you in that direction. So, again, just these kind of reflective questions before we have more of an open discussion. Now, what does your practice invite you? How does your practice invite you to respond to social inequality, social injustice, the seemingly growing and growing wealth gap, the climate emergency? How does the kind of big social, political, economic, humanitarian, ecological concerns that are current in our culture? And every culture and every time period has those concerns. They might not be the same, but every culture and every time period has political concerns, environmental concerns, social concerns. How does your practice art invite you to respond to those? And then the personal concerns, right? And how you spend your money, the ethical dilemmas. How do you meet? What do you do when you're confronted with homelessness in the streets of London? These things don't get spoken about on retreat, but this is absolutely the stuff of urban practice. Whatever arises for you in terms of the social injustice stuff, whatever arises for you, like in me speaking about diversity, the kind of hardening of views around immigration that's happening in some in kind of areas of politics, etc. Now these, I don't know where you go for those conversations. Maybe you go to your family. Maybe you go to your friends, maybe you go to colleagues, maybe you don't go anywhere for those conversations. But you know where would be a really, really good place to go for those conversations? Right? Sangha, other practitioners. It's frustrating talking about issues of the world with people who don't have any sense of interiority, right? Because we just find it so easily the discussion hardens into positionality. Right, and just a kind of clumsy batting back and forward of views and opinions. Right, Dharma practitioners, Sangha, it's a rich environment. So whether the personal views, you know, to the way Sangha can be a resource, and this is an invitation to any of you, if you like, well, not necessarily London Insight as a structure, though it could be that, but to any of you, and London Insight would be happy to promote it, to see what ways might you be inspired to offer a group that might meet. Might meet in a cafe, right? Doesn't have to be in silence somewhere, right? You might meet to explore whether it's the personal dilemmas, the ethical dilemmas of how I'm spending my money, or how I'm dealing with work colleagues, or how I'm doing in my relationship, or whatever. To use each other as a resource, or whether it's these more kind of social, larger issues. Okay. And just another couple of areas to mention before I let Richard and Miller speak a little bit and then hear from all of you. If they'd been in town, I would have invited Rohan Gunatilaka as well to speak, but he's in Glasgow. It's a long way to come. And he's the guy who made... He actually used to be very involved with London Insight till he moved to Scotland, but he made the app Buddhify, which you may be familiar with.
Yeah, use it.
Yeah. And so that area of Dharma entrepreneurship, you know, and some of you may shudder at even the juxtaposition of those two words together, right? But the stuff of livelihood around Dharma, seems to be a lot of possibility for the skillful bringing of the tools of your practice and the passions of your practice into the ways you work. Rohan's got tons of ideas for digital mindfulness products, for example. And then the other person I thought of was Jamie Bristow, who's involved with the Mindfulness Collective and the all-party parliamentary group on mindfulness. And, you know, you're no doubt very familiar with all the ways mindfulness is kind of spreading out into our culture, and sometimes in ways that we might think, well, that doesn't bear much relationship to what I know as practice. And some ways, inevitably, the more breadth there is, the more reach there is of the practice, the more there will be sort of flaky versions of it, or people offering versions of it that where they don't have a great deal of training or grounding in it themselves, etc. Just inevitable, I think. But at the same time, those of you who, and some of you spoke about that, who are interested in that, concerned about that, those of us, we might say, that if you have feel like you have a depth of practice and an integrity of practice and you're interested in that world, often within the Buddhist world, and I encounter this a lot with other Buddhist teachers, there's a lot of sort of griping about secular mindfulness. Griping about how well it lacks the depths or it lacks the ecological dimension, etc. But it seems to me futile to be on the edges thinking, well, we've got the real thing over here, and to criticise. If one thinks we've got the real thing, well, actually to cooperate, to be part of that world, to be part of that conversation. I started meeting with Jamie from the all-party group, and with another friend and colleague, we started a year-long mindfulness teacher training a couple of years ago, so as to kind of be part of that sort of conversation and influence in the culture, which is becoming, you know, an impressive and greater influence. Okay, so that's enough from me. How are you doing? Should we just take a couple of minutes to stand and stretch legs or something before hearing any more? Yeah, we'll just have a minute or two.